Welcome to podcast number 173 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is August the 9th, 2022, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Wendell Thomas. Wendell teaches in the Graduate Film School at UCLA, lectures internationally on screenwriting, and has worked as an entertainment reporter, development executive, script consultant, and a film and television writer. Her first Sid Redondo novel, Lost Luggage, was nominated for the Lefty and McCavity Awards for Best Debut Mystery of 2017. Her second, Drowned Under, was nominated for the Lefty for Best Humorous Mystery of 2019 and an Anthony Award for Best Paperback Original. Her third, Fogged Off, has been nominated for Best Humorous Mystery of 2021. Her short fiction appears in crime anthologies, Ladies' Night, 2015, Last Resort, 2017, and the Anthony-nominated Murder a Go-Go's, 2019. This is going to be a fun romp, and I'm looking forward to it. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Come sit by my campfire as we listen to crime fiction writers talking about their flawed fictional detectives. I will alternate weekly between award-winning and best-selling authors with debut authors who have overcome all the obstacles to get their first novel out into the world. This episode is brought to you by my own FBI agent Marcia O'Shea six-book series and my upcoming Gwendolyn Strong small-town cozy mystery series. To learn more, go to www.johnhoda.com, that's J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com, and join my email list. Liberty City Nights, my Marcia O'Shea prequel novella, is available to my subscribers there for free. Hi, Wendell. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. I'm so delighted to be here. I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. And when James Ziskin suggested you come on, we both said yes, and history was made. So, hey.
Yay to Jim.
Yes, good man. Hey, how is it out there in the City of Angels today?
It's kind of warm today. We're having a little bit of a Santa Ana situation, which is, I'm sure Chandler referenced that many times. But the so it's dry and windy. But it's been cold. We had a really cold winter, actually. So it's quite unusual the last 3 days.
Yeah, Chandler. You know, when you said Santa Ana, I just thought about the opening. I think it is up for Farewell, My Lovely. It might have the Santa Anas in there.
Yeah, and the sands coming in. Yeah.
Ah, that was some good writing. Anyway.
Yes, he's the genius.
Yeah, absolutely. And the literary folks had nothing on him.
No, they did not. You know, I totally agree.
No, they did not. There was, you know, he just happened to be a literary writer that just happened to write Philip Marlowe. But hey, we could digress on that for about an hour. So today, as we record this, it is Thursday, March the 24th, and 2022. So we keep this evergreen. And we're having a rotten spring day here in southern New England. Whatever those remnants of the powerful storm that pummeled the southeast and Louisiana with tornadoes has made its way up the coast now, and it's just blanking us in a cold rain. So not exactly, my crocuses are not happy campers today, but anyway.
We hate it when that late winter stuff kills all the flowers that we want so desperately to see.
Definitely, without a doubt. So hopefully my hardy crocuses will survive and we'll get through into a nicer part of spring. But anyway, I really want to dive into your entire background, your entire creative journey, because I think it's so influential to your writing. And for us to leave that out would be doing our listeners a disservice. So please tell me about your entire, you know, creative background and how we got to writing Sid Redondo.
Okay, well, I started out as like an English graduate student working on literature, and I was a Henry James scholar of all things, and I still love him beyond my life. But when I was in graduate school, they shoved me off to the film department to be a TA, and I was extremely felt unqualified. So I watched 400 movies in a year.
Woo-hoo!
I went to the library, the graduate library, and I just checked out one or two a day and watched them with headphones, in the library. And so I watched everything. you know, which was incredible. And that was, you know, the early 80s. So I didn't have as much to catch up on as you would now. But and so I kept thinking I was very suited for literary adaptation. I thought I was perfect for that, right? To, you know, kind of given my background. And so I took a leave of absence because all my professors said there were no jobs and they might come back, you know, which they didn't. So neither did I. But I came to Los Angeles and of course I couldn't jump into adapting novels because you have to have so many credits to be even allowed to do that. But I didn't know, my ignorance, you know, kept me from quitting. So I came out and I worked in TV development for a while. And then I worked for a film director named Christopher Kane, and I worked on Young Guns. I was the director's assistant on Young Guns. And that was a really interesting experience for me in a lot of ways because I was in Santa Fe for 5 months living in a hotel, which I loved. I got to know all of those actors as friends, you know, Lou Diamond Phillips and Dermot Mulroney and Charlie Sheen and Kiefer Sutherland. And that was really interesting. And then I kind of kept a lot of those relationships going when I came back to Los Angeles, especially with Dermot and his soon to be wife, Catherine Keener. So that was kind of my early days. I was working a lot, you know, on films and in the production end and the development end.
May I ask you a quick question?
Of course you may.
Was Charlie's brother Emilio also in that?
Yes, he was. And okay. But Emilio was, I really love Emilio, but he was far and away the most professional person on that film. So he didn't fraternize as much as everybody else did. He didn't. But Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen fraternized not just with the crew, but he was actually at that time, I think his attitude changed, but he was lovely to me, Charlie, always. He was very nice to me. So I'm fond of all of those people. And I also got to hang out with Terrence Stamp, which was probably like the coolest thing I've ever done.
The director. So,
well, no, Terrence Stamp, the actor who was in The Collector. And yeah. So anyway, he was the coolest. He's English. And so yeah, it was a very good time for me. And so when I came back from that, I kept working for that director, but I started writing a script, and I was, it's strange. I think I kept thinking about Dr. Faustus, which is a very weird thing. And I kept thinking, you know, is there a story if he says no to the devil, right? Is there a story? And I thought, well, I don't know if there's a dramatic story, but there might be a comedy story. And so I basically wrote a script about a woman who says no to a genie. Like shows up at her house and she's like, get out of here. I know what happens to these people, but he can't leave till she makes her wishes. And that was my first script. And I was incredibly lucky to get an agent with that script. And so that kind of started my screenwriting career, which was uneven, to be honest, you know, but I was very lucky. I had several interesting assignments. I worked on something for Showtime. I was one of, I think, 8 people who tried to adapt the Kipling's Just So stories for the Disney company. Mm. And I did a lot of other kind of side work. I worked for A&E Biography. I did the Maureen O'Hara biography. And I worked on Wishbone on PBS, which was the literary story that started Jack Russell Terrier. And I actually had to go to Dallas once for 7 days to learn all the things that a Jack Russell Terrier could and could not do. So that was pretty hilarious. So I have had a very, I had a lot of interesting jobs. I worked for the Discovery Channel, putting scripts together for The Operation, that show they used to have where they actually took you through an operation. I fainted almost every day looking at the footage. Yeah. So yeah, so I did a lot of interesting things. And then I started writing more or less, not full time, but I went freelance anyway in the early 90s. And so I've written ever since then. And but also I started teaching at UCLA, teaching screenwriting. So I've been there since 96 and doing that. And I think that the thing that really helped me more than anything else is actually teaching. Because in order for me to teach someone else how to structure something, I really had to understand it. And so I had to do so much work myself to to understand something clearly enough to teach it, that I think even though I did a lot of writing work over the years, and it definitely helped me, I think, with my pacing and my structure, In some ways, I think teaching screenwriting has done more for my novel writing than actually writing scripts did. I know that sounds weird, but I think that's probably true.
No, not at all, because dialogue is so important to the screenwriting, and there's so many things that you can't do on the screen that you can do in a book. So if you've learned how to master the screen, it can only help you with your writing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really funny because I couldn't. The one thing you can't do in a movie, unless you have a voiceover, is be inside someone's head. And I'm constantly crossing out stuff for my students. Like, this will not be on screen. You can't say in the description, he realized he loved his father. Because what are we going to see? Like him. So it was hard for me to do a first person narrative, actually, after that, because I felt like it was wrong to be inside someone's head. It was a really interesting transition.
Or like Ridley Scott, you can ask Harrison Ford to come back afterwards and do a very bad voiceover.
In Blade Runner. I know. I use that with and without the voiceover in class all the time. I do it both. Yeah. I do about the first 15 minutes with and without, and then the ending. Yeah. It's interesting to watch both ways, back to back.
Yeah. You know? The director's cut and the original, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is a detective movie. Yeah,
it is. It's a very good detective movie,
in my opinion.
Yes,
I agree. And, you know, Ryan Gosling, okay, 2049, Blade Runner. Yeah, okay. It was a good movie. It was. It kept my attention.
It was a better movie than people give it credit for, in my opinion. It was beautiful to look at. It was quite something. But I think, when you hold it up against the original, it's just almost impossible.
You know, and it's like, I got to tell you, what they did on the scene with Alien, the original Alien, versus all the CGI stuff that goes on these days. You go back and you look at that and you see what they did without CGI. And now that is movie making. So
no, that when that monster comes out of his chest and that's all real. No, that's all prosthetics and stuff. Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that memory back.
That is one of the most terrifying moments in cinema, in my opinion. It really truly
is. But anyway, so your screenwriting, your movie work has influenced your writing. Your being a screenwriter and also teaching screenwriting, being a professor at UCLA, no slouch school for the screen, obviously. I mean, they have a J school, they have B schools, and then they have UCLA for movies, So, I mean.
I was very lucky to land there.
So now, so continue, please. Besides, that was back in the mid 90s. So how did things start to happen at the turn of the century? I mean, to hear that, turn of the century.
I know. It's terrifying. So I did a number of, screenplays and assignments. I mean, a lot of times as a screenwriter, I don't know how many people know this if you don't know much about the movie business, but most of your work never gets made. Because you develop something with a producer and then somebody else buys the rights and they get another writer. Or there's many times I had a job and then the executive would be fired and you'd be fired or whatever. So it's that happens all the time. It's very different from novel writing. But I did get quite used to getting notes. And I think that's something else that's very valuable to novelists because you don't get anywhere near the number of notes or the kind of warring notes from your editors that you get in screenwriting, but you have to be able to listen to them and you have to be able to do it without like bursting into tears, or you have to be able to do it without, with really being able to think about, what is their perspective and is there value in this note and what's it going to do to the whole piece and all of that. So that was a great experience. So, and I had written, one of my favorite films of all time is Romancing the Stone. And I really love that film so much.
Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas?
Kathleen Turner.
Kathleen Turner.
Michael Douglas, yes. Michael Douglas. But love that movie. Yeah. And I feel like there's a real dearth of kind of rom-com adventure movies. They kind of disappeared for a while. And I think there were 6 Days and 7 Nights with Anne Heche and Harrison Ford, but there weren't a lot of them. They kind of went away. And I really wanted to write one for the 21st century. So I wrote this script called Animal Instincts. And that was the first time Sid Redondo showed up. And so it was done very much as a Romancing in the Stone kind of rom-com adventure. It took place in Tanzania, which is, and I set it in the world of endangered animal smuggling, because I wanted a different kind of crime. And when I started reading about what was happening in East Africa, I was so horrified. But it's a very complicated world, and there are a lot of moving pieces, and it just seemed like an interesting thing to look at. So I set the film there, and it didn't sell. But I just couldn't let go of Sid. And I tried to figure out why it didn't sell, and part of it was the time period. I think it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't hip at that time, but I also felt like there was actually a flaw in the script, which is that I hadn't made her flawed enough. So I went back to think about that, and I went to think more about her backstory and where did she come from and her family. And out of that, I think I came up with the idea for the novels. And I was also reading a lot of mystery at that time. I was reading tons of mystery novels, everything from every noir to every cozy. I'm a huge fan of Neo Marsh. I am Inspector Allen and Agatha Troy are my favorite married couple in all literature, I think.
Really?
Oh, I love them. The two of them. I just can't even stand how much I love them.
Okay.
And so but I was reading all the Sue Grafton, and I love Michael Connelly and T. Jefferson Parker and all, you know, everybody. And I'm also going back and reading, obviously, Chandler and
Hammett.
James M. Cain and Hammett and all that stuff. And so I just thought, you know, maybe Sid could be a series character, you know. And also I was reading, obviously, Janet Ivanovich. And so it seemed possible that, you know, you could have a comic female lead in a mystery series. And so I just started giving, just kind of trying it to see, because I'd never written a novel before. And I was terrified of it because, again, as a, you know, having studied literature, I felt like if it didn't come out like Henry James or Faulkner or something, or Flannery O'Connor, then I was just an idiot. And so it was very scary, actually, to write a novel. But I just started, and I did National Novel Writing Month.
And NaNoWriMo.
NaNoWriMo. And my husband laughed at me because he was going away for a while, and because I'm very slow. Normally I'm slow. And I said I was going to do this, and he's like, yeah. And I wrote 300 pages in a month.
Woo!
And they were crap. But you know what I mean? But it was kind of like the book. And so then it took me a year and a half to fix it. But I did it. That really got me started. So that's kind of how I got the book done. And then I had a lot of people, friends, read it. And I was, you know, I was a member of Sisters in Crime. And I had had, I guess, one or two short stories published at that time in some of their anthologies. And so I started to kind of see what could happen with it. And so that's kind of how it happened, but it definitely was a script first.
Okay.
And so I had a lot of the story structure worked out. I had to change it quite a lot because a series, you know, you can't wrap everything up at the end in the same way. And you have to leave strands open and all of that. And you have to set things up so that you can do a second or third or an 18th book or whatever. So that was a challenge, but a lot of the events in the script wound up in that first book, Lost Luggage. And so that was helpful to me, I think.
And that's interesting that you said that, that it went from being a movie script, so a screenwriter adapting a piece for the screen to a novel. And do you know of anybody else that has gone that route, has taken something from the screen and turned it into a novel? Not something pulpy so that it's out at the same time the book is out. But I mean, somebody that really just takes a screenwriting idea and then says, no, you know what? I think this is a better treatment is it novel.
You know, I think that there's, I think there are more and more screenwriters are writing novels now. And is it Ellie Semple who had such a huge hit? But I think the thing is, it's, I don't know. I wish I had more answers for that because I know there are more people doing it.
Well, you know, it'll come to you at 3 o'clock in the morning.
It will. Yes. That's exactly when it will come to me. But Ellie Semple, I think, is one of them. But I also, I think it's interesting because for some novelist or beginning novelist, I think maybe cracking the story is the hardest part. And that was easier for me because I had kind of done at least a pass on it, you know, if that makes any sense. And so,
how much did you borrow from the screen?
Oh, tons. Oh, okay. Tons. I mean, I think the thing that was hardest for me in the transition is that physical comedy is a lot easier to write in a screenplay than in a novel. It's really hard to write a novel because in a screenplay, you have the white spaces and you can do the pacing and the kind of punctuation with a line of dialogue or whatever. It's much, much easier to orchestrate it and make it read like the, you know, Joan Wilder, welcome to Columbia scene or whatever, and Romancing the Stone. You can do that in a script much more easily than in a novel because the prose is so much more dense and it's just harder. So that was far and away the hardest thing for me to do in transferring this series and the idea of Sid and the physical comedy and the adventure stuff to a novel form was by far the hardest part.
Okay.
For me.
Now, I had on the show a while ago a Brit by the name of Simon McLeave, and he came from years in the television industry and writing scripts for Broadchurch.
Oh, yeah,
and Broadchurch. Broadchurch, yeah. And other things. So when he decided to write a strong female lead in the DCI, Ruth Hunter, he had all that background too. And it just became a matter of doing the same thing you just talked about doing. But it was also interesting what you said was that your scripts got looked at by people that knew what they want to see in a story and if it could be commercially viable. Did I get that right?
Yes, absolutely.
The and part. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that I think a lot of times, that's why I felt like I was more qualified to write genre fiction than literary fiction. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because I think I had gotten some training, and obviously I needed that for my students as well, to have some sense of what is commercial and what isn't. And for example, like I said, when I wrote my script, the first Sid Redondo script, I think it wasn't a good time. Now, right now, because they're making Jungle Cruise 2 and because they just released The Lost City is coming this weekend, I think now people are looking for that kind of comic adventure.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Emma Watson? Did I get to?
Yeah, I think Dwayne Johnson and it was Emily Blunt.
Emily Blunt. Then, I knew it was began with an E. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's an E. No problem. And the new one is Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum in The Lost City.
Oh, that's
City,
right.
Which opens this weekend.
Yeah.
So I think now, you know, you have to kind of keep an eye on that, but you also have to remember that those scripts were sold 2-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you do kind of like to learn, but everything is a cycle. I teach a weekend on romantic comedy, like 12 hours. And every decade, there's something that, you know, whether it's they're all about divorce or they're all fairy tales or they're all cynical. You know, in the 90s were very cynical period, you know, and it's just interesting, but it's always a cycle.
Okay.
Always. So if you can figure the cycles out, it helps a little bit.
Mm-hmm. No, I get it. I will just briefly detour into my world for a second.
Oh, please.
I've enjoyed writing police procedural, six book series with a badass FBI agent by the name of Marsha O'Shea. Enjoyed the hell out of writing it, and now I'm dipping my toes into a first person, present, cozy mystery, small town mystery series. Now, I could write a little bit more to market. Yes, a couple of my books have chocolate chip cookie recipes, and I have this cute little dog in the story.
Right,
but they're not the primary drivers in my cozies.
Right,
and I am being I don't know. I don't want to call myself an infant terrible. I mean, I know I don't know how to even pronounce that in French.
It doesn't matter because we all get it.
Yeah.
We all know what that is.
But I really love the golden age mysteries of the 30s, Between the Wars, written by Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Emily Wentworth.
Yeah.
And I even go back to the turn of the century, not this century, the last century, with A. Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. So excuse me for wanting to go into that world. So I know that probably more cookie recipes and cutesy dogs would do me better now commercially, but you know what? It's what I like to write, you know, and I like writing my cozies with the idea, an homage to right. the writers I just named. And those are the books that I want to read. I'm more concerned about the whodunit parts of the story, the plot, right. than I am about, you know, what wine matches with what, you know, food on the table. You know, I just, in terms of a cozy mystery setting.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, my first agent never sent my first book out because she said it wasn't enough of a cozy.
Really?
And it took forever for me to go, it's not, to me to realize, it's like a screwball mystery.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Much
it's
better.
Not, she's an amateur sleuth, but she swears and there's sex and she doesn't stay in the same. I mean, she always starts in Brooklyn, but she always goes somewhere else. So it had so many things that were not cozy elements. And so it was really hard for me to find a place for the book.
Okay.
And I still think, you know, I'm not sure it's totally the series has found its true audience yet, because I think the audience is more, I mean, my new publisher feels like it's more Carl Heisen than, you know, than cozy. But I think that's, I would rather be in that lane. But I think that, you know, anytime you try to do something that's a hybrid of any kind, people just get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
They get nervous about it. And I had to stick to my guns and not, you know, my first agent said, well, she has to be in Brooklyn for the whole books and maybe the sixth book or something, she can go on a trip. And I was like, no, because I just want her to be a fish out of water.
Yeah.
You know?
And we're talking Sid.
About Sid.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, I like what you said, screwball mystery. And that, and maybe that is a genre, but you know what? the fact of the matter is, you're going to find readers that are going to resonate with Sid, and they can't wait for the next Sid book, you know?
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
People have been very kind about it anyway. So.
Well, you know, I think if you write to a reader that she resonates with, they're going to want more, obviously. So, but just if you could give us a little thumbnail of Sid, tell us a little bit about her, you know, her backstory and what makes her who she is. And then I wanted to read a little piece from your most recent, Fogged Off. Ah.
So, thank you. Yeah, well, I'll tell you a funny story. So Sid appeared to me one day. I was in Scotland running a screenwriting course, and I was sitting in this bar, and I just saw this very tiny woman with kind of reddish brown hair and a mini skirt who had I don't know, maybe 25 of those cheap flea market bracelets on her arm. And some guy came at her with a machete. She's in heels in the jungle and she just whacks him with those bracelets and knocks him out. And I just saw that. And I was like, who is that? And it was Sid. And so she kind of appeared to me that way before I wrote the script, obviously. But so she is... in terms, she's grown up in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which I talk about in the first book, is an NORC, which is a naturally occurring retirement community.
Mm-hmm.
And she's third generation travel agent. Her family has been running Redondo Travel since her grandfather came over or booked some things on the Titanic, which was not such a great thing.
No.
And so anyway, she's grown up in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which very much is where, you know, it's where Saturday Night Fever was set.
Yep.
And Peggy in Mad Men is from Bay Ridge, but it's a wonderful place. And I went to stay for a while.
A lot of car dealerships down there.
A lot of car dealerships, but also it's a very small town atmosphere. And the thing that I found when I kind of was lucky enough to meet people who live there is what they said was that you can't go anywhere you can't run in anywhere quickly because everywhere you go, there's like somebody from third grade and there's your eighth grade teacher. And and I just thought that was such a hilarious kind of environment to grow up in where you've dated everyone,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the whole community and everyone knows your business and all of that stuff. And how, at least for me, I would want to get out of there. But Sid's family, her background is that her dad died when she was four.
Mm-hmm.
In an accident. And so she and her mom were taken in by her dad's brother, her uncle Ray, and taken into the family. And she is the youngest cousin, and she has 10 older male cousins.
Oh boy.
So I call them brothers because she grew up with them, but they kind of took turns totally abusing her and protecting her from everybody else and her uncle as well. And I think because she was the only girl and also because of what happened to her dad, she's just been completely under surveillance, you know, for her entire life. And she lives in the attic room of the house. But so she is a travel agent in the first book who's never been anywhere. She's never been farther than New Jersey.
Okay.
And so all her knowledge is theoretical, which is what I wanted, because I think that the place between theoretical knowledge, everything you can read in a guidebook, you know, and what's actually happening when you go somewhere, that's where the comedy of the book lies.
Oh,
you
know, that is
between the theoretical and the reality.
And, you know, and I keep hearing this phrase in the back of my mind. Well, that's not the way it looked in the brochure.
Exactly. Exactly. And she's very savvy about brochures, and she's a very, very, very good travel agent. Like,
okay.
Great. And the thing about Sid that's probably the most important is that she is crazy responsible. And she looks after all her clients, and she sends them off with special care packages of every possible problem they might have. They all have a prepaid phone card to call her. They all have everything, sunscreen, you know, snake bite kit, like everything. And she specializes in senior citizens. That's her specialty for travel. So she's especially worried about them.
Okay.
And so she, her next door neighbor, who's a senior citizen, winds up dying in the first book. And kind of just everyone thinks it's a heart attack, and she goes to Tanzania. She wins a trip. And her uncle's never let her go anywhere. He's always wanted to put everything back in the business, or, you know, and she escapes. She runs away and takes this first trip ever on safari, to Tanzania. And so that's kind of how this series starts. And that's who she is. She, her family, her, the second book, focuses a lot. It's called Drowned Under. She's on a cruise in Australia looking for her ex-husband's parents. And she has a sidekick who was her, is a lapsed nun, who was her eighth grade teacher in Catholic school and now is a client. And then the third book, Fogged Off, her uncle, Leon, goes with her on this trip. He's a retired taxidermist. He was a taxidermist for the Natural History Museum in Manhattan.
Wow.
So she has a very extensive, one of her cousins is a detective in the Bay Ridge Police Department. She has other cousins that are, you know, work at the port and all sorts of things. So she's got that kind of family, and she's, her mom is Irish. So it's kind of half Irish, half Italian family. But she also, she's got, I don't know where this came from, because I wear jeans every day, but she has this thing about like mid-range designer clothing that she has to get at least 75% off. So she is always wearing, you know, I don't know, Stuart Weitzman shoes. And I don't know where that came from. That is not me. It just appeared with her somehow.
Well, I mean, possibly from that Lassie in the Scottish bar.
Yes, possibly. Yes. Possibly.
So, so you've given us a little bit of a verbal description of Sid. Here's from Fogged Off, a Sid Redondo Mystery, Book 3, Chapter 1, January 2007. Jack the Ripper had it made. Sid, if you're going to babble, babble en route. Debbie Pinkowski slapped a 20 on the deli counter, grabbed our Italian heroes, and shoved me out the door. Not endorsing spree killing or anything. It's just, you know, no surveillance. I could hear Debbie's eye roll over the click of my kitten heels. Seriously, the man, if it was a man, sliced up five women in public, walked home drenched in blood and entrails, and is still getting away with it 100 years later. I have one drink with Sally Jessup's cousin in Queens, for God's sake, and it winds up in the Bay Ridge Sentinel. Now I'm a pariah again. He's off limits. Everybody knows that. He's off limits for sex or marriage, not bourbon. Bourbon leads to marriage. I'm living, breathing 100%, 150% proof that that is not true. So I hope I did that justice. Okay.
You did very well, John. Thank you. She's very, she talks a lot. So it's hard to get all her words out sometimes.
I know, but it's still, right off the bat, we're settling into a nice relationship between her and her friend. You bring in Jack the Ripper, you bring in bourbon, you bring in a guy from Queens. I mean, and this is all in the first three, you know, paragraphs. So it's not overdone, but what it is just it's setting the stage for a real speedy romp, for lack of a better word. You call it a screwball mystery.
Yeah, I'm thrilled with romp. Romp is absolutely fine.
That's good.
If it's a romp, I'm happy.
Yeah. So we don't need to know any spoilers about Sid or any of the other characters. It's just that I think what keeps her driving? What keeps her trying to solve the mysteries? What is her primary driving motivator? What's her motivation, as they say in the book, in the movies?
Well, I think her motivation, two things. I think, first of all, she wants to keep everybody safe. I mean, that is really, she's like crazy, buys ultimate insurance and everything for all her clients. So almost always she's going somewhere to save someone or keep them safe. She's the travel agent that will actually like go save you, which is a huge fantasy, I think, but maybe one we need right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's always really trying to keep everyone safe and also keeping the business afloat because, you know, travel agents after 9/11 and with the internet, they're like endangered species themselves.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, it's been really hard for the family because the agency is the primary, you know, source of money for a lot of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so she needs to keep the reputation of the business alive at the same time. And part of that is keeping everyone safe and making sure everyone gets home. And in Fogged Off, not to spoil anything, because you find this out about three paragraphs later,
okay,
is that she has a client who goes to London every year. He's a Jack the Ripper expert.
Okay.
And he leads those Jack the Ripper London Walk tours in the East End of London. And he has died. And her cousin screwed up the reservation and there's no repatriation insurance.
Mm.
So it actually cost about $30,000 for someone to come home if they die abroad to get them home.
Mm.
And a lot of people don't know that. And there's an arcane kind of, I guess, clause, and you'll understand this because it's insurance, is that if you change the reservation in any way, which has happened, then the insurance is invalid. And if the insurance for the repatriation is invalid, it's and the travel agent made the, like, booked the trip, they are responsible for the cost of bringing the body home.
No kidding.
So she actually has to go and she to bring the body back in the least expensive way possible. So that's kind of the setup.
Oh,
of
I'm
the
thinking
story.
Of Hangover 3, but I don't want to go.
Oh, there's no, but there's it's really interesting. So that's kind of the beginning. So she's generally motivated again by keeping people safe. She really cares about her clients, and she loved this guy, Shep Helnikoff. He was one of her favorite clients, but also
what a name.
Know, yeah, he's one of my favorite characters, even though he's dead for the whole book. But but anyway, so that's kind of her motivation, is to keep her family safe, keep the business going, and keep her clients safe. That really is her. And also to get in any traveling she can, you know, in the few moments she has free.
Wow, that's a good story. So you've also written, besides Sid, you've also written short stories. But before we get to the short stories, how did you bring Sid into the world? I mean, you know, you talked about agents and what have you. Is this something that you found?
It was kind of funny, actually,
okay,
and maybe heartening for some people. So when I did finish the book and I sent it out and I signed with someone who was quite a good agent. She sells stuff all the time. I think she liked my voice, but she didn't actually like the book. That's what I think happened. And I kept trying to redo it for her. I think I told you she wanted it to be more of a cozy.
Mm-hmm.
And she just never sent it out. And I wasn't happy with what I was doing for her, and she wasn't happy with what it was. And so I finally decided to just fire her. Not fire her, but just say, you know, look, neither one of us is making any money. Perhaps we should reconsider this relationship. And I had, at that time, I was going to look for a different agent. And I had, at one of the mystery conferences, one of the editors at Poison Pen, Annette Rogers, had read the first five pages of the book. And she liked it and asked for more. And So I had one friend who was with Poison Pen, and she said she would talk to Annette and let her know. And because, again, they were not taking any submissions, but because she had looked at it at a conference, they were able to waive the submissions from a person, not an agent, you mm-hmm. know? And she read it and they signed, I had a 2-book deal like 2 weeks later with Poison Pen. So I actually was able to sell the book myself. Obviously I have an attorney who did the deal for me.
Yeah.
But it's heartening to know that if a lot of times being part of these organizations, being part of Sisters in Crime, being part of Mystery Writers of America or Romance Writers of America, going to conferences, all of these things can really help you when it's time to try to get out there in the world. And I'd really encourage people to, because at least in my experience, the mystery community is extremely generous
mm-hmm.
and people are lovely. And I mean, I would probably keep writing books just to stay in this community. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I met Jim. That's how I met, you know, all of these people. So I was really lucky that I had, you know, not only submitted those pages, but also, you know, knew someone who was with that publisher. And so that was how I got started. And I was very, very lucky to have Lost Luggage nominated for Best Debut Mystery the year it came out for The Lefty, but also the McCavity. So that helped a lot, I think, in my confidence.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I did the intros and the outros before we sat down to do this. And I saw that, you know, all three books have been nominated.
I've been so lucky. Yeah. I don't know who's doing that. So I don't know who it is.
And the Lefty is Left Coast Crime, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cool. Are they're having their annual at Albuquerque?
Yeah. This year? Yeah. I'm headed there with my husband in a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple guys that I have a mastermind group with. Oh, actually all three of them are going to be there.
Cool.
Frank Safiro.
Oh yeah, he's great.
Okay.
I haven't met him, but his writing is great.
Colin Conway and a fellow by the name of Dana King. So,
oh, cool.
So, and they're all going to be on panels. So
good. I'll look for them.
And
that'll be great.
Tell them that, you know, John and I will. And then they'll say, well, he owes us money. And then, I'm only kidding. But, Albuquerque. Yeah. That sounds like such a fun time. I'm kind of jammed with, I have the Crime Bake, which is the New England one.
Oh, right. That's always great. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to go to that. Hallie does that a lot, doesn't she? Hallie Efron?
Yes.
She's a friend of mine. I love her.
Yeah. And also, there, I'm signed up this year for International Thriller Writers, which is in Times Square. They moved it. They moved it from over by Central. They moved it from Grand Central Station over to Times Square this year. And then BauchaCon, which is out in Minneapolis in the fall. So I'm kind of booked with conferences so myself. But and I know what you're saying about conference attendance. And if you go with a plan and just make sure that you're not the flower on the wall, but actually engage with other people and talk to other people and then do things, maybe even volunteer. Right.
Yeah. Volunteering. Absolutely. I'm volunteering this time.
I mean, are you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. I always volunteer because a lot of these conferences are really volunteer run. And mm-hmm. the thing is, you never know who you're going to meet.
Right.
You never know who you get to talk to. And I'm very shy in a group. Like I'm one of those people that would find one person to talk to at a party. I talk to them all night long mm-hmm. and nobody else. But I've just made myself say, okay, whoever I'm sitting next to in a panel, you know, in the audience, I'll just say hello.
Yep.
You know, and just something like that. And it doesn't take, you don't have to be a social butterfly for it to help you, because I am not one of those.
No.
But it can be really helpful, I think. And if you do have a plan, so you're like, I'd like to meet five people, or I'd like to talk to two agents, or I'd like to mm-hmm. whatever it is, and then try to do that, I think it can really, and I've made a lot of friends, just friends, and gotten readers,
mm-hmm.
you know, from these conferences. So I'm a big believer, but they are expensive.
Yeah.
So you do have to pick your poison.
Yeah.
You know, you have to decide which ones make the most sense, I think.
Now, for me personally, when I first went to a BauchaCon in Dallas in 2019, I was a debut novelist with my first of the 6-book series. And
you've written 6 books since 2019. That's unbelievable.
Well,
that's so great.
Actually,
good for you.
Actually, a lot more than that. But
oh my God, yeah. I'd be dead.
Well, you know, I, 1750 words a day, except for one day of the week. So I do it. I do that 6 days a
week. Good for you. So that's like NaNoWriMo. You just living it. You're living it every day.
Yeah. But
that's good.
But I'll write in the daytime, and at nighttime, I'll do a little look at it again.
Right.
A very, very light edit just to make sure that the words are cohesive, cogent, you know, they sort of,
right.
You know, and then I go, and then I read it again the following morning, and that starts me off. Now, I'm a plotter, and I'm using the word T-T-E-R, not D-D-E-R.
Right.
And so I know what my next scene is the next day. So if I look at my scene list the night before and I see what I've got, it kind of goes into my brain what I want to think about. And the next day,
right, your subconscious, yeah, so there, you're ready.
I'll read, like say, just today I started chapter 5 of a book. I read chapter 4 as a warm up, and boom, I'm right into, you know, and I know what my scene is all about. So I know what marks I have to hit, my beats. And it's just, and it's not fill in the blank, but it's just like, I like to move it that way. And it's, for me, that's 3.5 to 4 hours. Okay.
Right. So it's amazing how much you can get done in a few hours if you're focused.
Yeah. And that's no cat videos. That's no TikTok. That's turning off all the notifications on my phone and in my computer. And so for those 3 to 4 hours, it's like I'm playing golf. It's about, right. You know, and I'm out there on the links and I'm just hitting the ball. It's the same thing. But anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. Oh, but I was talking about the podcasting.
Oh, Bowsher.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and going to Bowsher.
And I was a debut novelist, but I had only had maybe 50 or so podcasts under my belt. And at that time, I hadn't been really concentrating on crime fiction writers. I had been talking to private investigators, law enforcement people that, you know, I knew from the industry over 40-year career. And they were telling me about their real detective stories. So when I start to gravitate towards crime fiction writers, I've done so over the last 2 years, but I haven't been to a conference in live for 2 years. So now when I go to thriller writers and when I go to BoucherCon this year, and this is where I'm going at, I'm going to be known to about 150 attendees as the person that interviewed them on the podcast. So it's going to be a totally different experience for me. And they know 10 people, you know, that are going to be there. And for me, this is going to be really exciting because I've been waiting for this for 2 years coming out of the pandemic to be able to go and to meet my friends, because they're friends, and then learn who their friends are. And then maybe through that, making those connections like you're talking about, you make the right connection at the right place. I know the panelist that I sat next to, I was also a panelist that year at BoucherCon in Dallas. The person I sat next to had a wonderful copy editor proofreader. And then she did my books 2, 3, and 4. And I had to then go back and go over my debut novel because I got I got stung with a couple 1-star reviews for proofreading. And not the story, but, you know, little things like grammar, syntax, and spelling. And then she went back and went over that again. But had I not had that chance opportunity to sit next to that writer next to me, I never would have been introduced to that proofreader. So,
it's a really good community, and people are very generous in sharing. You know, if they've had good experiences with an editor or a copy editor, they'll tell you the truth about agents. They'll do, you know, it's good. It's really useful.
Definitely. Who do you read these days? You mentioned a few during your study days, but who are you reading? Who do you read for fun these days? Who can't you wait for them to come out with a new novel?
Well, I mean, I've always been a big Michael Connelly fan, and Sarah Paretsky, I love, and I got to meet her at BoucherCon, and I made a total idiot of myself, but I love her. So I will always buy her books right away.
You were a fangirl, huh?
I was a stupid fangirl. And then, then I went to the PI dinner and she sat at my table after I completely humiliated myself in front of her, but she was very nice to me.
You're talking about the Seamus.
So bless her.
You're talking about
the Seamus dinner. Yeah. So that was very nice. I love Matt Coyle.
Yes.
And Matt and Naomi Hirahara, Tim Hallinan, I will read anything. He's got a new junior bender coming out. I'm very excited about it. I love his stuff.
Yeah. Matt won a Seamus just recently for his most recent
book. Matt was one of my first editors on one of those short stories.
Oh.
And so that's how we met. And we've been friends ever since. We do speed dating together. We're like screwball and screw up. That's our combo. and we're going to do that at Left Coast Crime. We did it at BoucherCon. So Yeah, we're good friends now. We've known each other a long time.
Okay.
Now, and I love him
to
pieces. I always read T. Jefferson Parker when anything comes out.
Okay.
I think Jim mentioned Terry Shames. I love her stuff. I'm a big fan. I like a lot of Nordic stuff as well. I love Helene Thurston. Okay. I don't know if you've ever read her.
No.
Inspector Huss. I really like those books a lot. Who else do I love, love? But I go back and read a lot of old stuff. I do. I just reread all of Ross Macdonald and John D. Macdonald back to back, all of them.
Okay. That was
during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I know they're very politically incorrect right now, but I still love those books so much. They're both so good.
Yeah.
The writers. So I'm a big fan. I reread all the Chandler books every year, at least once.
Do you really?
I do, because they're just genius. And just because he's so funny, nobody gives him credit for being as funny as he is. And it helps me with mine.
Mm.
You know, I think I love him. And who else have I been reading? I love Val McDermid.
Okay.
I always buy her books when they're new. I like Ellie Griffiths.
Now, this is a new question, and it just started with last week. Who do you like to listen to as opposed to read? If you had a choice between reading or listening.
You know, I don't listen to books at all.
No?
I don't do any audiobooks. I don't. I like to read.
Okay.
So, and I want the voices. I want to make them up in my head.
Oh, okay.
So I don't listen to – my husband is English, and he grew up with Radio 4, and he listened to podcasts and books and stuff all the time. But I just read.
Okay.
So that's – it's a good question, but I'm the wrong person to answer.
Okay. No, the reason I said that was because I don't read Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum. I listened to her, and the narrator is, and I learned the full name of the narrator, Lorelei King. I had heard Lorelei on a previous podcast by Joanna Penn, and I know that I save my Stephanie Plum novels for when I've got an 8-hour drive.
Right. And they must be fab. I should do that.
Yeah.
I just haven't.
Well, and you're in LA. You know what traffic's like. So
yeah, I mean, when I'm in traffic, I listen to music.
Oh, okay.
I have like, I don't know, 19,000 songs on my iTunes or something like that. So I'm a huge music fan.
Okay.
So I listen to music when I'm driving. It makes me calmer.
Okay.
I don't know why.
No, I tend to like podcasts myself. I tend to like a good book on audio.
Yeah.
But
makes sense.
It's just a new medium, and I'm asking people about it if they had a preference. You know, who do they listen?
Yeah.
Who do they read? Who do they like to read in print, whether it's in a book, a hardcover, soft cover, or on their Kindle? And who do they like to listen to? Because it's becoming a new thing. And
it's huge. It's huge. It's probably bigger than books at this point, almost.
I think so, but I'm not sure. I don't have the math for it anywhere. So we're at the end. But it's been wonderful. How can people reach you, Wendell?
Well, if they spell my name correctly, which is always hard because my mom is insane and misspelled it. But you can find me at WendellThomas.com. So that's WendellThomas.com.
Okay.
And I'm on Facebook under the Sid Redondo Mysteries.
Okay.
You can find me in Wendell Thomas there as well. I'm on Twitter. At E. Wendell Thomas.
E. Wendell Thomas.
E. Wendell Thomas. My first name's Elizabeth.
Okay.
And I have an Instagram account, but I've never posted even one post. So you'll be very disappointed if you go there.
And your website's clickable for contact?
Yes, absolutely. I've got my email contact is there.
Okay.
And it's got my bio and it's got articles and interviews and all that kind of stuff as well, if anybody wants to look at that stuff.
I did look at that stuff and it was amazing. It was very nice and I enjoyed it. And that's where I was able to navigate to where I got to the Amazon fogged off first page. So I hope I did it justice. I mean, I tried to
you
put
did,
my voice
you
on
were
it.
Very kind to do that,
well,
I have to say.
You know, there are times when I look at the look inside and I read it. And I try to find something that I can take a paragraph of. And if it's demonstrative of the character, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And there's times when I don't, you know, and it's not a slight to that writer who I may not read for. But if I know that by reading that piece, it brings out more of Sid, in our conversation, then I do it. Does that make sense, what I just said?
Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, it depends on people writing in first person or what the first scene is, mm-hmm. or all of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always, it just depends.
Right.
And I think I'm sure most people agonize over that first page. I certainly do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think that it's very deliberate, the first page, or it should be. Mm-hmm. And so it's not always about the character's voice, depending on where you are in a series or anything else.
Right.
You know?
No, I know that from writing the series that I talked about.
Right, yeah.
But I could look back at maybe one of those six books and say, you know, I could have done a better job on that opening hook or on that opening couple
paragraphs.
Well,
you always feel that way.
Yeah.
You're like, no matter what, once it's published, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
I know.
But anyway, I feel good with the other ones in terms of, okay, that's a good hook. That gets started. That gets moving.
Good.
And maybe I could argue why I did it the way I did it, that one book, because that's where I wanted to start it. You know, I love those editors say, you know, they look at your manuscript and say, well, you know, your book really starts on chapter 5.
No, I always wind up cutting like 25 pages out of the first 50.
Really?
I have to write them to get back into the Bay Ridge world and stuff, but I have to get her out of town.
Okay.
And so I always cut 20. I always know that I've written 25 pages too much.
Really?
In the first 50. Always. Oh. All three books.
Okay.
And this next one's set in Bali. And I'm doing it right now.
Wow.
I'm writing too much right now to get her out of town. And I know I'm doing it and I'll be able to fix it later. But it's just my process.
That's process. That works. Well, Wendell, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today. It was fun.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, John. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all your listeners for listening. And I hope we see each other at one of these conferences someday.
Thriller Writer, Left Coast Crime, Baushakan, they're out there. And
they're out there.
Definitely.
They're out there. All right. Well, thank you so, so much for having me.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. I hope I've earned your interest and your time. Our guest next week is Kathy Stoller. Kathy is an Amazon best-selling author. Her urban thriller, Last Call, the second book in the Murder on the Rock series featuring the Corner Lounge bar owner, Jude Delane, was published in November 2020 by Level Best Books. The third book in the series, Straight Up, was released in 2021, November. Her series with blackjack player Nick Donahue includes the novel Out of Time and the novella Nick of Time. She is also the author of a three-volume Laurel and Helen New York mystery series, which includes Telling Lies, Keeping Secrets, and The Hard Way. And she was a three-time finalist and winner of the 2015 Derringer for Best Short Story, The Kaluki Kings of Queens. Very involved in the crime writing world, Kathy is a member of Sisters in Crime New York Tri-State Area, Mystery Writers of America, and International Thriller Writers. This is going to be a fun interview, I promise. This episode was brought to you by my own FBI agent, Marcia O'Shea, six-book series, and my upcoming Gwendolyn Strong Small Town Cozy Mystery series. To learn more, go to www.johnhoda.com. That's JOHNHODA.com and join my email list. Liberty City Nights, my Marcia O'Shea prequel novella, is available to my subscribers there for free.